Good evening and welcome to Wednesday's Late Debate. Joining us here in Studio 10 tonight, we have Fine Gael Senator Barry Ward, practising barrister and Shannon spokesperson on justice, Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central and spokesperson on education, arts and social protection, independent TD for Sligo Leitrim, Marion Harkin, and in adjoining studios, we have Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, and Professor Emer Shelley, Dean of the Public Health Faculty at the Royal College of Physicians. Now we want to hear from you, so do please get in touch with us. You can text us on 51551. You can email us on latedebate@rte.ie or you can tweet to @latedebaterte. Well, there were bitter and personal exchanges in the Dáil today between Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald and the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, sparked by the ongoing controversy over the cut to the pandemic unemployment payment for some recipients. Here's a flavour of those exchanges.
New wage subsidy scheme excludes 153,000 workers. They're not eligible, and you have left them out in the cold. Very deliberately. Fact. Number two, you've cut the PUP payment. So another 150,000 or more workers are down 50 or 100 euro a week. Fact. Can you set out for us and move beyond your sort of delusional reverie and into the real world with the rest of us?
You use every situation to tell the untruths and not to tell the truth in relation to the reality out there. You're wrong in terms of wage subsidy scheme. You're fundamentally wrong. And you deliberately distort what is actually a very effective and unprecedented intervention in the labour market to protect employers, to protect enterprises and to protect workers. Can you not acknowledge that? Can you not acknowledge that a very substantial intervention has been made? Why do you feel this need always to distort and always to try and smear people who are definitely trying to do their best, because you do it for political advantage all of the time.
That's not a point of order. I know we do not have a fact-checking facility for the Oireachtas, but the facts that I have set out as regards the wage subsidy scheme and the PUP are accurate, and I would like that recorded on the record of the Dáil. I don't appreciate being accused of laying untruths before the House. That is not true.
And that was Mary Lou MacDonald earlier today. We're hearing this bad blood spilled over into the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting with Micheál Martin again, accusing Mary Lou MacDonald of making political capital out of where we are now. Mary Lou MacDonald hitting back that she is doing the job of opposition and that Micheál Martin is deflecting. Hugh O'Connell, that all sounded really personal to my ears. How is it being read in the Dáil?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been building up to this point, Katie, where I think Micheál Martin has become increasingly, and Fianna Fáil, senior Fianna Fáil figures have become increasingly frustrated with what they view as Sinn Féin's kind of cynically exploiting the pandemic for political purposes. Now, Sinn Féin would obviously deny that and point to the fact they've been constructive when they needed to be constructive, but that they have very obvious concerns with the government's approach to the pandemic, and in particular this cut to the pandemic unemployment payments and the issue arising in Dublin, where tens of thousands of workers have been made redundant or facing redundancy in the coming weeks as a result of the level 3 restrictions, and they're getting a pandemic payment that's significantly less perhaps than they were getting.
Yeah, just on that line, because Micheál Martin very strongly saying, you know, you're telling untruths, you're twisting, you're distorting. Yeah. Mary Lou MacDonald insisting that her facts, what she said was factually correct. Was it fair what she was saying?
I think it was. I think she was using figures that Piers Doherty had obtained from the Department of Finance a few weeks ago, or certainly in recent weeks anyway. But I think Micheál Martin's problem seemed to be the fact that he believed that, you know, there was no acknowledgement of the huge state support that has been afforded to workers up and down the country over the last 6 months as a result of the pandemic, and that he believed that she was linking the withdrawal of the reduction in the pandemic unemployment payment with the Low Pay Commission issue, which is related to ICTU pulling out of the Low Pay Commission earlier today because the Low Pay Commission wasn't going to recommend any increase in the minimum wage.
They were going to recommend a 10 cent increase,
yeah,
I think.
Excuse me, yeah. And ICTU did not believe that went far enough. So Mary Lou MacDonald, in Micheál Martin's eyes, was trying to conflate those two issues, and he was pointing out that the Low Pay Commission is a body independent of government and makes recommendations to government, and the government has, in previous years, implemented those recommendations. But I think that Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are coming to blows now. Partly it's a reality of the polls showing that Sinn Féin are well ahead of Fianna Fáil at this point, and I think Fianna Fáil are feeling the pressure in that respect. I think Micheál Martin's feeling the pressure in that respect, and I believe that he feels that he needs to hit back because Mary Lou McDonald is very strong and has very strong political capital at the moment. And so does Sinn Féin, and it's at the expense of Fianna Fáil.
Yeah, Marion Harkin, were you surprised at the tone and the tenor of not just today's exchange? This is, as you were saying, there has been building up.
Actually, I am, and perhaps it's become because I come from the European Parliament, where we always looked to find compromises, to find ways of working together. Now, it's a completely different system, and I understand that. In the European Parliament, there's no majority, there's no government, there's no opposition. So you have legislation in front of you, and you try to find agreement. You don't always find it, but a lot of the time, you go part of the journey. And for me, coming into the Dáil, I have found it a bit of a culture shock. Now, I'm not going to lay blame or say who's right, who's wrong, but I have found it that. And I'm trying to see as a TD how I can negotiate that, how I can, add value to what's being said, but to do that in some kind of a positive way. But yes, for me, but I do recognise it's a completely different system, and it's extremely political.
And it's adversarial from all sides.
It's not just the government and Sinn Féin. If you go to the Labour private members' motion today, it was People Before Profit and Labour, and it was other TDs and Labour. So it's across the board. But for me, it was a big change.
To go to the substance of what the row was about, Barry Ward, this cut to the PUP, a lot of rumblings in the undergrowth now that this is going to be reversed. Would you not advise your government colleagues to just go, if they're going to reverse it, do it now and save themselves a couple of weeks in the run-up to the budget of this, demanding and rancour?
There may well be something in that, but I was listening to Minister Humphrey speaking about this, and one of the things she said that hit home with me was that this payment has to be sustainable because we're now looking down the barrel of this going on for an awful lot longer than anyone ever intended. It's already run at twice the cost of job seekers allowance, and there's been an expenditure, I think, of 3.5 billion euros so far in respect of the PUP alone. So if we are going to make that sustainable, if we have to pay this for another 6, 9, 12 months, it's not sustainable to keep it at the level it's at, however much everybody might like to do that. And I think, Marion's a really interesting perspective there, because there is a different tone coming in, and these personalised attacks have become kind of de rigueur and the norm.
They've been personalised attacks, and they're all going back to when God was a boy.
What I was going to say was, Mary Lou McDonald there said this is a fact, and her figures may well be right, but what she also threw into her fact was that this was done cynically, or that this was done with the intention of targeting certain people. That's not a fact. That's not a figure that was given to Piers Doherty by the Department of Finance. So what I'm saying is, she does conflate these issues, and that's political, and it is politics. And as you say, it was ever thus, and it was much worse if you go back to the 30s and 40s. There were all kinds of things.
But the pandemic is political, no matter how, it is political.
It is because everything that
involves society generally is political. So political decisions are being made every day in relation to the pandemic.
Politics with it is different to it's being political. The reality is we all want to achieve the same thing out of this. We want everybody to get back on an even keel, and we want everybody to be able to come out the other side of this in relatively good shape. And what the government is doing, I think, and I don't speak for Micheál Martin or Fianna Fáil, but I do feel that the government as a whole is trying to make sure that we have the means to do that at the other end of the crisis.
Do they not have lousy timing, though? Because, timing, they say, is everything. So they announced the 10 new special advisors for the junior ministers on the day that the actual day that the PUP is cut. And then we hear about this substantial pay rise for TDs, senators, civil servants on the day that we hear that the lowest paid people are being offered 10 cents.
I don't disagree with you. The funny thing is, if the timing of those announcements were managed, the opposite accusation would be made, that they're holding back information or they're timing these things to suit themselves. So, six of one, half a dozen of the other. I hear what you're saying, but I think at the heart of this is the fact that nobody wants to actually reduce it. But the reality is, two things. Firstly, we need it to be sustainable. And secondly, when you look at the pay increases that you've talked about, they are part of agreements that are beyond the government. They're not decisions that are made by the government. They are long-standing agreements that have been in place and are beyond the government's
decisions. Okay, I know, Marion, you want to come in, but I want to get Gary in before we move on. Yeah, Gary, in relation to that, how these are being handled, is it risking the social solidarity that we are so desperately trying to hold together?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't accuse anyone of trying to be unfair in terms of targeting, but when you look at sectors which are excluded from going back to work, like the live event industry, for example, or the tourism sector, I mean, it's totally unfair to ask them to place their lives on hold and then tell them what was worthy of 350 back in February is no longer worthy of that now. These are sectors which are they're indigenous sectors in the Irish economy. They were hard fought for and built, and they're coming into the Dáil through the COVID committees and wherever, and they're telling us if we don't step in and support them now in a very substantial manner, they won't be around. I mean, it was actually my conversation yesterday with the minister that was picked up. I raised the issue of, say, electric picnic, for example. It brings 36 million into the Irish economy, very substantial for the area of Laois. If that doesn't take place next year, that's a huge loss to our economy. So supporting those people now, and let's face it, that 3.5 billion, it's not lying in bank accounts. It's spent in the local butchers, it's rejuvenating their towns. That's money that we just have to be able to spend. And it affects social
solidarity. What happens if it isn't there, Gary? What do you do instead?
But is it there at the minute? We're being told we have access to financial markets.
Spend it while you have it. And when you run out of it in February, what are you going to say to those people?
We're being told that we have access to financial markets, we can borrow. And while we can do that, we have to be able to do it. If it comes to April and actually we turned around and said there's no longer any money in the kitty, people would understand. But that's it. People would understand if you get them full access to information. I trust the citizens here, Barry.
But can I, and I'll go to you then, Marion, but just that idea that we're being told, you're alluding to there again, that it's simply not sustainable, you know, to keep these payments up at that level is not sustainable. The low paid workers were being told that the 2% on €10 an hour is not sustainable for low paid workers because obviously everyone is in difficulty.
That is a different figure.
No, but I'm saying this is what people are hearing. People are hearing all that it's not sustainable but somehow 2% increase for somebody who is already earning over €90,000 is apparently sustainable.
Well, there's two important things there. Firstly, though, the 2% increase for civil servants, etc., that is a subject of agreements, as you well know. It's not something the government decided to do today or yesterday. It's the subject of agreements that were made a long time
ago. But should political parties not tell their TDs and senators that we're not taking this?
Whatever about that. I mean, first of all, that's not going to solve the problem. That's the first thing.
Are you going to take that pay rise?
To be honest with you, I only learned about it in the car on the way here, so it's not something that I have thought about for a moment. But I don't think the solution is telling politicians they should be paid less. We already have a difficulty getting people into politics. Politics are well paid, but I mean, I don't dispute that. But the point that I'm making is, you see, you are now conflating two issues. You're conflating the agreements that are made for the civil service primarily. It just so happens that politicians' salaries.
Hang
on a second, Gary.
Public confidence.
Yeah, and I'm going to get you if you'll just let me.
So they're not conflating two issues.
Yeah, you are conflating two issues. Well, let me explain to you why you are. Because the politicians' pay is pegged to civil servants, and that's why it's going up. It's not the politicians have chosen to increase their pay. That's the first thing. The second figure
go right back to the start of that, and it was done in exactly that way so that we wouldn't be having a conversation about politicians increasing their own pay.
The second figure that you mentioned was the 2% on the minimum wage. That's not being paid by the public purse or by the government. That's being paid by small businesses all over this country. The very businesses.
No, but people are hearing people in studios around the country telling them that this is not sustainable, but on the other hand, this is something that's just happening.
They're two totally separate streams, sources of income. You cannot expect small businesses
say to the people listening out there tonight, two totally different streams of income. They're concerned about what's in their purse or their pocket to pay their bills. And if they're on the PUP and it's being cut, and to be honest, I cannot see why. It's not a social welfare payment. It's a safety net for those who have lost their jobs, largely because we, and I say we as a government, have closed down those sectors. So they're looking at the Dáil and they're saying, 2% extra. And you cannot say to those people it's a separate revenue stream because they just know that their money is being cut.
But
and
people are smarter
ours
than that, Marion.
Isn't.
People know.
It's nothing to do with being smart.
You're suggesting
it's
that people,
nothing to do with that. It's no, hold on. No, it's no. The reality of people's lives. You know
of course
it, because you talked about
it. Okay, Marion,
people
I'd love to keep it where it is. But would you not also agree that if we don't manage the fact that we know we're going to have to pay this over a longer period of time, we're eventually going to run out of money? And what
I
are you going to say to people
things.
Next April when there
I
isn't money there?
I say two things. The government can borrow. All countries are borrowing mm-hmm. right now.
But that's a fine
There's
act.
No issue. Yes, of course. But you know something? It's in many ways, how long is a piece of string? And all countries recognise that they need to support workers. And I believe that the PU payment should not be cut. Why are those who are losing their jobs now less entitled to some kind of a safety net? A lot of these people have mortgages. A lot of these people just don't have the normal day-to-day expenses.
They aren't less
and
entitled.
To see,
but there is a reality
to see
the situation.
The reality for them
Barry.
Is they don't have
the
money to pay their mortgages.
Pay rows,
and to see politicians getting 2% extra. To see politicians getting 2% extra. It sticks in people's craw in
what,
a way.
What should be done? Like Barry's honest. Barry's reasonably saying that this is something that was agreed. It's a pay. Obviously, it's rolling
yes.
around at the time that it was set to roll around. But you have gifted back pensions and
I have.
Do you think that's what we should be doing? This is
I think it's an individual decision for politicians.
Just explain to people what you did and why you did.
Well, that was when I was in Europe. Mm-hmm. I discovered I was entitled to a pension from the Dáil. And the day the pension levy came in, I gifted back my pension for the rest of my time there. And I gifted back over €200,000 to the state, 220 something. Because I couldn't take my pension when people here were paying a pension levy. I never spoke about it. It was never in a newspaper. And the only reason this ever came to public view was in the last election. The various political parties decided they had to find a way to get at me, as politics is, and they started talking about all those pensions that I had, etc.
And you were able to go, ta-da!
Yes, and I got a letter from the Department of Finance, just like Piers Doherty did on his figures, to say that I was factually correct. But look, that's an aside.
Are you going to take this pay rise, Marion?
No. And you know something, Katie? Let's be honest. When I signed the document today saying I wouldn't take it for the 3 months that's left, it came to 400 and something euro. And if half of that has gone at tax, etc., it's 200 and something. But you see, it's the optics that people see and the sense that some have an opportunity to take it and just others don't. And I honestly think that this should never have happened. We shouldn't have got here today. We shouldn't be talking about it tonight. I have no more right to the high moral ground than anyone else. None. So we shouldn't be talking. This shouldn't have happened.
OK, Gary, we are talking about... Are you going to take the pay rise,
no,
Gary?
No, I'm not going to take it. No, it would look brutal. And we're paid enough as it is.
Yeah, I've just seen here, could the government be reminded that any payment to those unemployed by state COVID-19 restrictions and protocols are actually the taxpayers' own money, money they are more than entitled to in return for AYE and PRSI payments made by them. It is not a government private stash subject to benign largesse. Everything in the Dáil is political, for God's sake, says a tweeter from Jamie. A bit rich for Barry Ward, saying Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin
don't
pandemic.
Think I mentioned Sinn Féin.
Was saying, am I going to do that? For political reasons. What about, oh yeah, saying that Sinn Féin is using the pandemic for political reasons. What about Leo and his pronouncements pulling the rug out from the Taoiseach? One rule for those in power again, says Robbie Cronin. And then another, it's not a pay rise, it's pay restoration going back to 2008 levels for 12 years. Are you going to take it then? I've asked my other two guests.
I don't know anything about it, to be honest with you. I only learned about it today. I'll certainly look at it, but I don't know anything about it.
You're getting a 2% pay rise.
Yeah.
You're going to take it.
I don't know. Like, I don't know.
It's kind of a yes or no answer, to be honest,
yeah.
Barry.
Yeah, but I don't know the answer because...
I think some politicians are going to take the pay rise, and I think that's the issue. You know, a good way around this for the government, perhaps, would be to just bring forward a motion or legislation ask every TD to vote on it to not accept the pay rise. I mean, that would be a good way of killing this as a political issue and a political controversy. You know, Barry makes a point perhaps in terms of, you know, do we pay our politicians enough in this country? But I think in the midst of a pandemic, when people's incomes have been really hit by what's gone on over the last 6, 7, 8 months, it's just not tenable for our politicians to be taking pay rises at this time. And I think they should probably lead by example in that respect.
The other issue, and Marion, you were raising this today, is sick pay and parental leave.
Yeah.
Because I know of this personally. I know of lots of other people in this found themselves in this situation, that if there are issues with other people in your house or kids in school, or that people can now find themselves having to stay home from work for all sorts of reasons. Some people can't work from home, so, and some people do not have sick pay or parental leave arrangements that they can fall back on. So you were raising this today, Marion.
Yeah, well, it was a Labour Party motion on sick pay and parental leave. And to be honest, Katie, we're not going to solve this problem overnight. There are, out of the 28 EU members, 23 or 22, I'm not sure, have sick pay, some of it quite generous. Germany, for example, 6 weeks of full pay. Belgium, 30 days of full pay if you're sick, or for what they call force majeure as well, if you have to take time off. For example, if your child is sent home from school because of COVID or whatever. Now, I don't expect us to get to that stage. And to be fair to the government today, they did say that they would examine this, but they're pushing it out for 6 months. And the issue is now, and I don't expect it in a week or a month, but I don't want it pushed out for 6 months, during consultation, etc. Because, as I said today, simply, there are families who woke up this morning who found themselves in that position and never thought they would. And there are families who'll wake up tomorrow morning and find themselves in that position, that they have to make a choice about, well, I'm not entitled to sick pay, or the sick pay I get wouldn't pay my bills, etc. So do I stay at home to look after my child, or do I self-isolate as I'm really supposed to? And I think COVID has brought it to a head. We're way behind the curve at European level. But to be fair to the government, they said they will look at it and consult, but it's more urgent than that. And I think they are interested in moving forward, but I think their timing is well off.
Yeah, midst of a pandemic, the absence of sick pay is a threat to the health of the general public.
Now, I suppose, just not so people know this as well, it's important that there is a COVID payment there now in the system that was put into the system to ensure that people who have to leave work can draw down a COVID payment immediately. Isn't that was one of the new payments that was introduced?
I'm going to have to look up at that. I haven't seen. I just know in the meat factories and some of the other low places of income, the fact that people weren't able to access sick pay meant that they were going into work. It's been a huge problem, particularly in low income environments, in shopping centres, in everywhere else. So in the middle of a pandemic, I just think we need to legislate for sick pay. It's quite an urgency. We can't wait for another 6 months.
And I think it's important what the point Marion was making there, because in many cases it's not that people are sick, it's that a child has had to been sent home to get a COVID test.
Your child gets sent home from school.
Or your child or somebody in the house with you is a close contact, and now suddenly everyone in the house is restricting movements and can't go into work. And that's a huge issue. I mean, there's nothing wrong with you. You're perfectly fine, mm-hmm. but you can't go to work. Barry?
Yeah, there are two issues there, as I understand it. One is the statutory sick pay, which we don't have. And I actually agree with Gary. I think that is an issue that needs to be addressed. We are behind the curve, Marion is right. And that's why I think the government is saying that they want to address it. Now, I don't know about the timelines, to be perfectly honest with you, but I would support the idea that we would put something in place there, because there is, I mean, beyond COVID, nothing to do with COVID, there's an issue that needs to be addressed. But in the context of COVID, when people have to leave work, either because they themselves are sick because of COVID, or because they have been told they must self-isolate, my understanding is that there is a payment there for those people specifically to address exactly that scenario, for exactly the public health reasons that have been mentioned. So that is covered, and people should be in no doubt that if they fear that they're a close contact, or they have a symptom, or they have a child with a symptom, that they can leave work and they will be covered.
Yeah, and I just wonder if that message has gotten out to the groups of people that really need to know.
But
that.
Isn't this exactly the issue that arises when certain politicians conflate the issues for political advantage? And yes, of course, these things are political, but when you play politics with it, and at the same time complain about the messaging from the government, what you're deliberately doing is confusing the messaging, and exactly this kind of difficulty arises.
Yeah, but you know, just on that last thing where we were talking about the contrast between what people see as people who are looked after by the system and some people who maybe might feel now abandoned by the system. I was really surprised to see this today. Ken Fox was writing about this online today, saying that if a TD or a senator goes sick, it's not just the salaries that are protected. They could actually seek to have travel and accommodation expenses paid for the period that they are sick, and they can ask for a reconciliation of attendance so that all your travel and accommodation gets paid, even if you've been sick and you haven't been travelling or looking for accommodation anywhere.
But the only thing I'd say about that is because the travel and subsistence pays are over a year. So I presume that I don't know the details, but I presume it's on a pro rata basis in terms of, like, if you fall below a minimum attendance, you don't get it. I think no matter what the circumstances of it are.
I'd be surprised, Katie. Now, I don't know.
No, this is from Ken Fox.
But I would be surprised if I was paid attendance for my travel and for my hotel bills when I'm in Dublin, if I wasn't here. I think.
But you must have a minimum number of attendances over the year. So that you have to meet a minimum threshold.
And I think if they're saying if you're going to go in during the COVID period, you can get a sworn affidavit to say that you were there or you were working from your constituency.
But you were there. It wasn't that you weren't there.
Exactly. So I think if you weren't there, you don't get paid. I mean, from my circumstances, for example, senators have to attend, I think, 91 days from the 1st of July or something like that. If I don't attend 91 days, I don't get the allowance. Mm-hmm. Or whatever way, I'm not sure exactly how much they cut off it. I don't know if it's pro rata or how much you have to return, but it's paid on a monthly basis, and it's spread over the year. So it's slightly misleading to say that if you're sick for 2 weeks, you can get paid your travel and subsistence.
Well, you still have to, saying that it's not just salaries that are protected. And look, I know Ken Fox, he's a details man when it comes to this kind of stuff. But we will take a break there, but stay with us because I want to talk to Professor Emer Shelley, Dean of Public Health, the Public Health Faculty at the Royal College of Physicians, after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, people might be surprised to hear that public health specialists we've been relying on so heavily since the arrival of this pandemic to these shores are threatening strike action over status and resources. Public health specialists from the Irish Medical Organisation have agreed to delay a decision on strike action for 2 months, given the ongoing public health crisis linked to COVID-19. I'm joined now by Professor Emer Shelley, Dean of the Faculty of Public Health Medicine at the Royal College of Physicians. Professor Shelley, many thanks for joining us this evening. Maybe you can just help us and describe what exactly does a public health specialist do?
Thanks, Katie. Well, public health specialists usually work across a number of domains. We're very familiar now with the work they do in health protection, as they are doing in COVID, but they'd look after many other infectious diseases in settings such as nursing homes, schools, etc. They also work on what's called health improvement, to maintain the health of the population, to advise on living situations, environments, and how to reduce the illness that results from our lifestyles. And they work on health service improvement, so working on, say, hospital statistics, for example, and looking at differences between different hospital groups and planning services on a population health basis. And all of that then is underpinned by access to data and information systems and providing advice out to relevant management or indeed to the public across those issues.
And in relation to where we're at now with the pandemic, is it the public health specialists, am I, have I got this right, are involved closely with the contact tracing programmes?
Thanks, Yes, that's a good question, actually, because much of the media just covers it as test and trace. And that's what happens. The tracing happens within the contact management program for, if you like, the basic cases. Obviously, the testing is done, is arranged by GPs and done in laboratories, but the complex cases are dealt with by the 8 regional departments of public health. And by complex, they mean cases that might be working in a healthcare setting, but have community settings also, or the vulnerable settings potentially in factories, workplaces, etc. So any place that there is a danger of spread from a case is referred to the local department of public health. And it's really important that those two systems are well integrated and are under a single governance and clinical governance so that the public health department views on what needs to happen to get those systems most effective are taken on board.
And there was a bit of kerfuffle last week when Professor Philip Nolan said, you know, that we need more resources for public health. I'm sure you wouldn't argue with that. But that we weren't, that we were in contact trace and we only had the resources really to go back a couple of days when there was a confirmed case in terms of, you know, who people might have been in contact with. And that was really to discover who they might have gone on to infect, rather than going back maybe 5 or 7 days to get a handle on where they might have picked up the infection themselves. What is the story? And then he sort of walked back a little from that after that. So what is your understanding of what we're able to do in our contact tracing as of now?
For the regional departments, there has been deficits in the workforce, not just during the pandemic, but for a number of years, because the staff who left weren't replaced in a timely manner. And when there were replacements, sometimes they were put into national departments, and that has left reduced capacity in local departments. So this issue actually was discussed at the press briefing this evening, and Professor Nolan wanted to clarify that in many, many countries, they don't actually go back beyond those two crucial days where people are most likely to have passed on the infection. It does happen for some cases in some of the departments where they have the capacity, and so they can link the cases not just back 2 days, but go back 5 days, for example, but go back sufficiently long to be able to link the cases and work out where the case originally came from into a particular outbreak.
All right, so what you're telling me is that it's patchy, is that in some cases they're able to do that, mm-hmm. they have the resources, yes. and the cases, but in many cases they simply aren't the people or the resources in place to do that sort of detective work.
That's exactly right. And there is an urgent need for a capacity and stability in the workforce of the public health departments.
So is there a number on the number of specialists that you need? And if we got those specialists, would we be deploying them in this way? Because we've been constantly told that we need to hunt down this virus, but obviously we don't have those resources, as you describe it.
Public health specialists and consultants are much in demand, as you can imagine, and it's one of the reasons why granting consultant status without delay would be very helpful, because it means it would be possible or more possible to attract back some Irish doctors who are working in other jurisdictions. But the specialists could lead teams, for example, additional professional staff, nurses, infection control nurses, surveillance scientists and so on. So obviously physicians, if it's possible to get them, and indeed other doctors who could assist, it would be really helpful. They would certainly not be twiddling their thumbs. They could be on the ground in areas where there are a very high number of cases and communicate the message directly about the importance of seeking a test if people have symptoms. They could arrange a test if necessary. They could also really bring home the message about following all of the advice about restricting movements, isolating and so on in a way that is not possible perhaps over the phone. So teams on the ground in areas of really high incidence could, for example, be a way of deploying any spare capacity should that arise in the future. It's certainly not there at the moment.
And is this the only medical specialty that doesn't have the post of consultant, you know, in the career path? And why is that?
It is the only specialty, and it's a very long story that originated back in 1995, and I don't think your listeners particularly want to hear it.
No, we mightn't go back all the way there.
Right now, but it came to a head, if you like, firstly with what's called the Crowe-Horwitz report. There have been quite a number of reports and reviews, but in 2018 the Crowe-Horwitz report was published, and subsequently Gabriel Scali's cervical check report also recommended in the foreword that there be additional public health consultants taking a lead role on topics such as screening. So what happened then was there is a parallel process involving, say, the professional development and the reform that's needed, and the IR issues, the industrial relations issues that were being progressed with the Irish Medical Organisation. Now, some of the reform components got put to one side on account of the pandemic, but the industrial relations issues progressed, and there was a lot of disappointment when the meeting between the IMO and the Department of Health last week informed the IMO that that reform would be required, and there were other issues of major concern to them. It's not for me to speak for the IMO, but it caused major upset among colleagues, as you can imagine, who have been working very long hours with very few opportunities for any break really since last January, and they took it very badly.
Yes, because I suppose we just assume that, you know, the supports are out there for the public health specialists, because as I said at the top, we're relying on you so much at this time, but you're saying that that's simply not the case as of now.
Mm-hmm. So in my view, what needs to happen is that the dialogue on this needs to be flipped over. In other words, there has been so much discussion, quite understandably, about the capacity of intensive care, but Public Health 101, the ladybird version, the Peppa Pig version, if you like, is that the first priority is actually to prevent illness in the first place. So if we had sufficient capacity in public health departments, as well as in the testing and tracing and general practice, then it would be possible to not just get the current high level of cases down, but retain that capacity so that information, education could continue, but also dampening out any small outbreaks that occurred, really tracking back cases, really identifying sources, and in that way protecting the economy, protecting the other aspects of the health service, including ICUs, and protecting society more generally.
Okay, will you stay with us, Professor Shelley, because I just want to open this out to the panel. Barry, that's quite shocking though, isn't it, that we don't have the capacity to actually do what I, up until last week, really understood we were doing, which is trying to establish the sources of outbreaks in various settings.
Yeah, and we're very lucky to have people like Professor Shelley who do such good work, and as you say, we're relying on them now. I mean, in every aspect of the health service, there are things that we would like to improve. I don't know enough about public health and the specialty of it to say what we should exactly be doing. Obviously, there is an issue there. I didn't realise the issue went back to 1995 either. But I'm aware that there is engagement between the Department of Health, the HSE and the IMO.
Time to pick a fight with public health.
It is, but wouldn't it also be unfortunate if they pushed home their advantage at this stage as well, when we're relying on them? I mean, it is, of course, a bad time. It's always a bad time to pick a fight with the medical profession, but particularly now in terms of public health.
Oh, you're saying that seems like a charge of cynicism at public health push home their advantage at this
what
time.
What I'm saying is that if, for example, industrial unrest were to break out now and there were to be some kind of a strike, that is really, really unfortunate. It's unfortunate for everyone, and it would be a real shame if it happened, is what
I'm
saying.
What's equally unfortunate is that this was a pay agreement that was reached in January 2019, and since that time, actually, nothing has been advanced. And now that we're relying on public health more than we've ever relied on them before, what they're saying is we're going to give the government 2 months to come come to the table with an acceptable, negotiable position. And if that doesn't happen, then they will, and I'm not going to use a cynical phrase, I'll push out on their advantage, but they will ballot their members to see if they take
it's not cynical. I mean, what I'm saying is it's not in anyone's interest for this, for the relationships to break down here. We need, as has been said, we need public health doctors, we need public health experts, and particularly in this area and at this time, of course we do. And I welcome the fact that there is now a time for this to be resolved. What I'm saying is nobody wants this to break down.
Absolutely.
And it would be a real shame
you're
if that
a member
happened
of the government
now.
You're a member of the government party.
No, well, you say that, Gary, as if I'm somehow a member of the government, I'm no more than you are. I'm merely a member of the legislature, exactly the same as yourself.
So we can accept the fact that there's 2 months
delighted
there now.
That
let's
you
get
think
around
I have,
the table.
I think I'm delighted you think I have so much power that I can tell the ministers what to do.
Well, you're sent here as a government representative, Barry.
I'm not. I'm here as a member of the Shannon. That's what I'm here as. I'm not speaking for the government. I can't speak for the government. I'm not a member of it, any more than you are.
Marion.
Well, I think what would be unfortunate is if we can't reach some kind of agreement, because I had a quick look. Your researcher told me this might be coming up this evening, and to be honest, I was unfamiliar with the issue. And I just checked out what Simon Harris, the former Minister for Health, had said last year. And in a response to a question, he said that he expected that he was asked about a timeline, and he said he hoped that the new structures and the contract for the grade would be settled by the middle of next year. Now, that was last December. So, in other words, it was reasonable to expect that there would have been, it's settled by June, July of this year. We're now nearly at the end of September. So it's a bit like Brexit at one level. We have people who have significant disagreements. It's time to come to the table. We need them. They need us. This can be resolved. From what I've read about the Crowhart report and what the minister said, I think we can find agreement. And it's really important that it happens, because nobody wants to go to the brink on this. Least of all, I'm sure, the doctors concerned.
Absolutely. Hugh, if I can bring you in on what Professor Shelley was saying to us there about the difficulty in doing the actual detective work and the resources that aren't in place. That's a real issue, isn't it? And will become a bigger issue as time goes on.
Yeah, it's a massive issue. I mean, you know, one of the ways that we, I suppose, live with this virus and go about our what were our normal lives as much as possible is having a proper testing and tracing system, and, you know, I suppose that being properly funded and properly resourced.
I'm thinking about the restaurants, restaurant owners and publicans last week who were asking, reasonably enough, I suppose, where the hard evidence was that the current rise in cases was being seeded from restaurants and those pubs that were open. And we were being assured that the evidence was there, but, you know.
Well, I think based on what Professor Nolan said last week, I think in his thread and in subsequent comments, was that, you know, the majority of cases were household transmission, but people bringing COVID into the household were picking it up somewhere, and the likelihood was that they were picking it up in, you know, settings such as gyms, such as restaurants, bars, so kind of social settings and in social situations where they were coming into contact with a lot more people than they would in their household necessarily, and that is perhaps where they were picking it up. And the evidence for this seems to be kind of international evidence more so than any kind of, you know, quantitative data that's been picked up here over the last 6 months. And why has that not happened, I wonder, is a question that has to be asked. I mean, I think a big problem for the government.
Well, we can hear now from Professor Shelley why it's not happened. Because they didn't have the manpower or womanpower to do it.
But this is it. But I mean, this goes back to, you know, how we live with the virus and having a proper testing and tracing system and having kind of public health officials to help implement that, and that it properly be properly resourced and properly backed up. And one of the things the government failed to do, I think, and I think a lot of the opposition have pointed this out as well, is that over the summer, when the virus was in abeyance, or was certainly the number of cases was falling quite dramatically, we didn't put in place a proper test, a professionalised testing and tracing service, an agency almost, like a state agency, on a full-time basis, properly resourced, properly staffed, to do this work. And that's now becoming a problem, because now we're facing into a situation where you have the HSE Chief Executive Paul Reid saying to the Cabinet COVID Subcommittee last week that we have a limit in terms of the amount of tests we can carry out. It's 100,000 a week. We can maybe push that a little bit if we bring in extra lab capacity from Germany, but that actually there's a worldwide shortage of lab capacity, so we have a limit on the number of tests we can carry out. And my understanding of this virus and the way in which we had to live with this virus was testing, that old trope that was trotted out at the beginning of this, and you know, is still true as far as I can see. But you know, we haven't properly resourced that system from what I can see, and the government didn't take the opportunity perhaps over the summer to do that. I know that they've said in the Living with COVID plan there's quite a substantial plan to ramp up testing and tracing, to hire more staff to do this. But why wasn't it done over the summer, I think, is the big question now that we're facing into a very long winter.
Yeah, if I can bring you back in, Professor Shelley. Is there a sense that more could have been done over the summer when, you know, when we weren't fighting the big flames, and that more systems could have been put in place to ensure that we'd be better placed going into the winter now?
Yes, I advocated really from the end of May or certainly in June for a temporary increase in staff while more permanent staff were being recruited, because there was a real need for stability as well as capacity in public health departments. Some staff have been recruited, but it's not sufficient. I have to say some outbreaks are being fully investigated and linked back to the original source, but there isn't capacity for all of them. And just really to make sure that everybody understands that the perception of public health doctors, or certainly of myself, would be that industrial action is probably recognised by the politicians as being something that public health doctors can't really do at this point. They're working well outside their contract, but professionally and ethically it would be really difficult for them. So my perception would be that it's the management system is taking advantage of public health doctors rather than the other way around. Just to correct that.
Well, I just got a text in here telling me to quit the fawning over the public health doctors. Disgusted with the differential interview with Dr. Shelley has been subjected to, whereas other less well-paid sectors are treated as pariahs when they mention strike action.
Well, as I say, the original industrial action on this was back in 2003. So this is not taking advantage of the pandemic, I can assure you. And just also to point out that there is evidence that investment in public health and indeed in the testing system, but particularly in public health, would provide great value for money, not just in terms of the pandemic, but across the other domains of practice of public health.
Okay, and just before I let you go, I want to touch on the issue of international travel and aviation and all of that. And I know Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said today that this proposed EU traffic light system for air travel is still a bit up in the air, was the quote. And of course, yesterday Ryanair again threatened to close its bases at Cork and Shannon for the winter unless the Irish government adopted this traffic light system for international travel. Professor Shelley, would public health be concerned at what might happen if we, loosened the reins on aviation and air travel and arrivals into this country?
I suppose the first point to make is that there aren't sufficient controls in place for those already coming into the country, regardless of what type of country they're coming from. There's only so much follow-up being done on people who are filling in the electronic form. The difficulty with the traffic light system is
Why isn't that happening? Is that another manpower issue?
It may well be. I can't answer that. I just know that only a proportion of those coming into the country are being followed up.
I cut you off there. You were making a point.
But the other difficulty is that the incidence of the virus changes so rapidly. So we've had a lot of coverage here about, say, Northern Ireland and the UK, but there are also a very high 14-day incidence in countries such as Belgium, the Netherlands, France, Luxembourg, and so on. And it's really, and it changes so rapidly. So if somebody is planning to go abroad, they need to be able to imagine what the incidents will be like in X week's time. And that's virtually impossible. So there will be a lot of instability within that traffic light system, and concerns then about people coming back from those areas, because the issue really is whether or not people have to restrict their movements when they come back. But of course also there's the risk that if they became ill while they were abroad and so on. So it's a very complex issue, and I suppose the public health advice, if I was talking to a friend, would be people are advised not to travel unless it's essential, and for some family reasons, or indeed perhaps it business reasons, there is essential travel. But if it's for leisure purposes, my personal advice would be to avoid it.
Okay.
Just to ask Dr. Shelley a question just about testing, etc. There's been a certain amount of talk recently about maybe other types of testing, saliva, gargling, etc. They may be less sensitive, but I'm not sure how much so. And does she have a view on that? Would they require the same kind of lab capacity? In other words, are there, in her opinion, you know, other viable options that are certain, that are worth looking at?
There are tests in development, and my understanding is that NPHET on an ongoing basis is reviewing the evidence on all of those types of tests, and if one becomes available that is reasonably accurate and very accessible and perhaps a very good value for money, they might well see it as appropriate in some settings.
Okay, I just want to bring Barry in on this. What do you make of those? I mean, Michael O'Leary has been out a lot on this. We are apparently the North Korea of Europe,
yeah,
in terms of how we are managing our air travel.
One thing I know for sure is that we should not be making decisions in public health on the basis of what Michael O'Leary is telling us in press releases.
Yeah, but it's not just Michael O'Leary. And no, there's a lot of people like, in Shannon and down in Cork and in that end of the, that side of the country, yeah, who are really, really worried. And Willie Walsh has been out and saying this is a huge, huge problem it and is. They need decisions.
And airlines have suffered probably, I don't know if I could say more than any other sector, but certainly very, very significantly. And I was really sorry to see that Ryanair threatened to withdraw service from Cork and Shannon. That would be a huge blow to those areas as well as to Ryanair, it has to be said. But again, we cannot conduct public health decisions at the end of the
battle. But is it not reasonable for people who are in their position to say, just make a decision on
That's it. Reasonable. It's not reasonable to say, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, we're going to pull our services. That's not reasonable.
Yeah, but then just get the other side of that. Why have we not yet?
But the European Commission hasn't finalised its protocols in terms of the traffic light system either. So we have to wait for that to happen as well. The things cannot happen overnight just because Michael O'Leary wants them to.
Just to give an indication, yeah, Roisin Shortall raising the doll today that 370,000 passengers have come into Ireland since August, mostly from non-green list countries, and only a quarter of those have been contacted to ask how and where they're quarantining.
Eimear Shelley was making that point.
It's an extraordinary point. I mean, that's a failure of governance.
Yeah, and yet, if you look, but again, we see from the data that we have, and I'm beginning to wonder about that data, but very, very small proportion of the cases, the confirmed cases that we know of, are traced back to travel.
Yeah, but it's not all a traffic light system as well. We see this evening that Germany has placed Dublin on the list, that if you're coming from Dublin, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks. So the truth is, countries move to protect their citizens, their public health. And while I can see where Michael O'Leary is coming from, and obviously huge concerns
are
about
their threats.
Are we out
of step, though, Marion? Are you familiar with... I saw the Taoiseach, or the Taoiseach, saying today that he noted that there was no direct flight from Belgium to Berlin when he was in Europe this week. So you say maybe we're not that, you know, there is huge restrictions across Europe as well, his point. Do you have a sense that we are particularly strict on this?
I think we were stricter, yes. I don't know in detail, so I'm not going to pretend I do. But from what I've heard, it does seem that we are probably more strict. But to be honest with you, I would largely agree with that, because we have to take decisions based on our own situation. And I agree, certainly not because of what Michael O'Leary, and as they say, good luck to him, he has his business to run, and I understand all of that. But that should not impact on, you know, the decisions we take in regard to public health. And as I said, Germany had no problem today, you know, abandoning the traffic light system when it came to Dublin. As far as they're concerned,
we're a risk and they're not going
that's
to.
That's it.
They're not
going and to we have to take the same view.
Okay, I'm just a couple of last texts there. Public health departments are on their knees. I spent a few months redeployed to public health. Serious lack of staff, says one texter. Another, Katie, I'm a medical student in my final year. I placed top in my class in our public health studies and would strongly consider a career in the field. It's often thanked as work and the kind of work that people only realise how vital it is when it is lacking. That draws me to it. However, there is not a hope that I would practice in Ireland as it stands. And that is all we have time for. I want to thank my panel and I want to thank you all for listening tonight. Just time for one headline from the Irish Examiner. Officials dismiss COVID-19 apartheid team leading state's response rejects herd immunity suggestion. And this one caught my eye. Meat processing firm defends charging workers for PPE. This is a story about Manor Farm, the chicken processing plant. Pay slips seen by the Irish Examiner showed that some staff had up to €80 deducted directly from their wages for the price of PPE during the pandemic. Okay, I think we'll hear a bit more about that. But for now, that's all from us. The programme was produced by Caroline Dalton. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. And Gar Duffy was on sound. And now it's over to Colm Murray on Late Date.